Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming to probably the least technical session at this event. By way of introduction, you'll see a little bit more of me later in the day. I'm doing the lock note at the end of the day. My name is Norman Judah. I'm the Chief Technology Officer of a Microsoft Services Organization. Have been on the road for a couple of weeks, was at TechEd in New Zealand, spent some time in Sydney, had a wonderful time up on the north coast here, north of Cairns, which was just beautiful, and then came down here to spend a couple of days with you guys. Been watching the tweeting that's been going on in real time. It's sort of been fascinating to watch the different events and the different approaches. Wandered around last night a little bit. Great buzz. It's actually pretty interesting to see the interaction between people, just the buzz that's going on. Interesting enough, this event, like many of these TechEds around the world, I also run an event inside of Microsoft called Tech Ready, which is the internal view, the equivalent view, which we do twice a year, actually. And one of the toughest problems that we have, and in fact Australia looks much the same, is the diversity of the audience. And so each one of us has a pretty tough obligation to try and help as much as we can to increase the diversity. And that's a little bit about what this talk is about. Inside of Microsoft Services, we have about 300 architects and about 3,000 wannabe architects. And we spent a lot of time trying to think about what makes an architect, and sort of parallel with that, what constitutes technical leadership. And in any company, large company or small company, I spend quite a lot of time talking to folks about what it means to be a leader, but frankly, in the context of our business. And our business is building out infrastructures or building out great applications. And so we've put together a program internally about how to grow technical people inside of Microsoft. But what we found is that it turns out to be pretty pertinent generally to anybody. And so we've been talking a little bit about this externally just to help people understand what our perspective is, and hopefully we can help some of you think about the roles that you play inside of your companies and what it is that can help you change and help you migrate up that role, but also a little bit of introspection about what roles it is that you want and don't want. And so I've merged together two threads in this talk. The first one is a little bit about architecture and what architecture is, and then that leads into the broader view of technical leadership. And those things are actually different and discrete. Previously, inside of my organization, inside of the services organization, the sort of ranking was we had somebody was a junior consultant, senior consultant, principal, and then became an architect. An architect was just a better, deeper principal consultant. And then about 5 years ago, we actually forked that into two different roles, the architect role and the principal role. So if you want to be the best and deepest DBA or BizTalk infrastructure, designer, deployer, you would go up the sort of principal track. But if you wanted to get involved in architecture, that actually became a different career track, role track. What we found, though, was that in the marketplace, there's a lot of brand cachet attached to the title of architect. Your grandmother would love to know that you're an architect and what that means. And so there's a dilemma between the brand of architect and actually the role and what people do. And so what we've tried to focus on is what is the behaviors of leadership, not necessarily what are the skill sets or what are the technologies, but more the behaviors that we're expecting people to see over time. So let me start with this. By observation, and I'll talk a little bit later in the lock note about this, we're in this era of architectural discontinuities. The interesting thing about where we are today is the current discontinuity that we're under is in a transformation towards the cloud. We're sort of into the early days of the cloud. But if you go back over history, discontinuities happen all the time. And the question for us, technical leaders, is how do you navigate careers through discontinuities? How do you navigate what you do, what your company does, what your customers do, through these various discontinuities that have happened in the past and frankly are going to happen in the future again? And so let's take this definition of architecture. Pretty hard to define, but I took a cut at it that says architecture is a constrained set of degrees of freedom. In other words, you take a very broad problem set and you define an architecture, and when you do that, you constrain degrees of freedom. And out of those constraints comes predictability, repeatability, and the ability to design to a particular problem set. If you actually look back in history, you know, a very successful platform, I'll date myself a little bit, was the old IBM mainframes running CICS, COBOL, DB2. Turns out there's not many ways, different ways to write those applications. And as a consequence of that, you had millions of developers write really boring banking applications with bad user interfaces that have been in production for 25 or 30 years and that run many of the banks and airlines of the world today. That becomes because of the constraints that were implicit in that environment. What then happened before the internet, essentially, when we ship products and other companies ship products, we gave you a very open product and a compiler and said, go have a good time. You can get access to all the APIs. You can do anything you want. Then people started hacking, and we started to constrain what we made available and set the defaults off instead of on for many things. And we changed the constraints of the problem set. The architectural problem is really thinking about what are the constraints that you're going to provide in the domain that you operate, whether it's you're thinking about management constraints, whether you think about operations, application design, database design. In each case, you need to think about those constraints and how you're going to apply those constraints. Let's look at a story. Imagine you're sitting in front of the planning and priorities board inside of your company, or if you're a consultant, you're doing it inside of a customer. You throw up a picture that looks like this. And you said, you know, we've gone out, we've done an analysis of all the systems, we've got too many systems, we've got databases hooked up everywhere, we've got schemas that don't match. Really, trying to build anything on top of this is going to be impossible. So here's what I need you to do. If you invest in me today, some very large sum of money, $10 million, I will create this beautiful orthogonal architecture. And underneath this architecture, there'll be a message bus, and all the databases will be neatly lined up. There'll be a single schema. Everything will be exposed as a web service in some fashion. And I'll be able to build systems today that hook into it and systems tomorrow. And I'm sure that each and every one of you in some way have had this conversation. However, if you go 10 years later, guess what you see? It turns out that architectures are organic. We tend to think of architectures as being structural, steel-oriented. In fact, they're not. They're kind of more sponge jelly-like. And what happens is that architectures move. Architectures change. The day you install it, your architecture starts to migrate and change. And so what is it that you can do to prevent this? I'll leap ahead a little bit. But if you think about building out a solution like this, how much have you thought about instrumenting your application or instrumenting your architecture so that you can actually understand what goes on and understand as things change? And things might change because your user profiles are changing, the database changes, functionality gets added, your company does an acquisition or divestiture, and your whole system architecture changes. What have you done today in the systems that you build today to help you understand how applications change? I mean, many of us go in and build applications. We get some user to sign off. You get a special tick mark and a gold star. And then you disappear and leave the application behind. And application or infrastructure, both of those are true in this case. And in many cases, they do move and they do change. And so the question really is, how do you build durable architectures? And so I think of architecture as actually kind of three things, two things and a variable, which is the first one is it's a science. It's the science of identifying durable architectural artifacts. When I speak to customers, both on the road as well as back at Microsoft, one of the questions that I'll ask them is, how many bets have you made as a company? And you'll have the infrastructure guys on this side of the table and the app guys on that side. And a bet equals write a big check. And I'll give you an example. Microsoft invested very early on in our buildings, on our campuses around the world, in wireless networking, when all the wireless networking was still 802.11b, you know, that old 11 meg stuff. And so we invested heavily in infrastructure to be on the leading edge of wireless. But if you remember, pretty quickly, B went to G, and G went to N, and N's going somewhere else. And we had landed up in this incredibly large, writing a check to one of the big networking vendors who shall remain nameless, to install a wireless infrastructure that within about 3 years was obsolete. And so the second time around, which was a couple of years after that, we actually redeployed a complete new wireless infrastructure from a different vendor. But this one was modular in nature that allowed us to swap the radios without actually changing the backbones or the hardware that we've got. You just plug a new radio system in. We wrote a second check. But the second check that we wrote to a different company was much more durable than the first one. And so that's the my definition of a bet. A bet is when you actually invest real money. If you actually think about technology investments as opposed to people, infrastructure investment, 20 years ago, companies would be just thinking about TCP/IP, and private to that had probably had ducknets or SNA nets running. TCP/IP has actually been a pretty decent bet for 20 years. IPv4 has actually been great, lasted a long time, pretty durable from an asset perspective. If you made a bet on TCP/IP a while ago, you've actually done well. However, it's been quite disruptive because, as you know, we've run out of IPv4 addresses. So everybody's switching to IPv6. You've got IPsec. Guess what? You're back to your networking vendor with a large check again to install some new infrastructure, new routers, new switches, new NICs if necessary, new software that you're deploying in order to support the new IP standard. The question is, will IPv6 be as durable as IPv4 was? XML is another one that you might bet on. And you could take that bet all the way up the stack where many companies bet on SAP for their application suite. Decent bet. Lots of people are running SAP today. The cloud's being very disruptive in the ERP space. And the first vendor that does cloud-based ERP is going to have an amazing advantage as the next transition occurs. And so architectural artifacts is a hard problem. The corollary to investment is if you know that this is not one of your core assets, you kind of know that it's throwaway, quote. And throwaway means you can still invest in it, but you know that your investments are short-lived as opposed to being that longer-term investment. How many of these can you have? Well, in any company, I don't think you can have more than 5 or 6 of these big investments because otherwise you're starting to dilute what is strategic and what is important. And so as I talk to many companies, I'll actually go ask them, go back and make a list. Invariably, they come back with 10 to 20, and then I'll ask them to prioritize it and draw a line about where they think strategic investments are. And strategic investments are a combination of a technology bet and, frankly, a vendor bet as well. So that's the sort of science part. The art part of architecture is really interesting. It's the art of simplicity. Talk to any architect who's finished an application, you've now put the application and infrastructure out, people are starting to use it, and the first thing that any great architect wants to do is go back and redo what they did. And they want to redo it because they know exactly what they've done wrong, they've seen the usage profiles as they've emerged, they really understand what is the essence of what they're doing. And when you look at architectural diagrams, mostly drawn in Visio, that makes massive wallpaper, it's very easy to look at a picture of an application or an architecture and understand the simplicity of it or the complexity of it. Simplicity is really hard. Being able to articulate a system, a complex system, in simple terms so that anybody can understand how it works is an amazing skill. And it's part art. It's part experience and, frankly, part wisdom. Architecture, for me, is the balance between these two. It's the balance between the structural engineering, and the artistic designer. And so the dilemma for us all, is this balance between being an architect, as in building architect, and being a designer, building something that is fantastic and durable, where everybody can admire it, not only for the way it looks, but for what it does. And so many of us deal with this dilemma today of the balance between these two. Unfortunately, most of our technical leaders, frankly inside of Microsoft but inside of the similar audience, spend most of their time thinking about structural engineering and not enough time thinking about the design aspects of what it is that they're doing. There's a fairly simple knowledge model put together by one of the Microsoft researchers, Bill Buxton. If you don't know him, go to his website. It's just billbuxton.com. He's the epitome of the nutty professor. He's a fantastically interesting guy. He's been a researcher in computers for 25 years, done some fantastic work, and I'll talk about some more about him later. But he's come up with this T model of knowledge that talks about breadth and depth and the difference between literacy and expertise. Literacy in this sense is a horizontal view where you actually are knowledgeable about stuff. Expertise is when you really know what you're talking about. And so the body of that T is how deep can you go in the domain that you're working. And so when we look at some of our technical leaders, we actually look at them across three dimensions. The first one is most obviously around technology. Do you know the ins and outs of the technology, technologies that you're working with, and how they interact with other technologies? The design aspect of what you're trying to do, which is incredibly important. And then finally, the business context in which it runs. As I talk to potential leaders who are looking for promotability and progress inside of Microsoft, one of the first questions that I'll ask them is, tell me about the business of the company that you're working with. We did one of these reviews recently, people review, in fact, did some of these when I was down in Sydney earlier last week. And we had a conversation with somebody building a messaging system. This is not in Sydney, this is actually a US-based company. Doing a messaging-based system for a company that does big hardware stores. And my question to him was, why does, the store was Home Depot, just to put it in context. Why does Home Depot need messaging? What is the business of Home Depot? And if you can't tell me the business of Home Depot, you have no right putting in a messaging system. Because you really don't understand what they're trying to do. How can you architect and design a messaging system if you don't really understand what it is that the customer is trying to do? It turns out that Home Depot, which is a big box hardware store, similar to, I guess, what Woolworths is doing here, I saw an ad the other day, they really have two businesses. The first one is inventory. Because when you're doing some home repair, you're remodeling at home, or you're doing some work out in the garden, and you're missing a piece of plumbing, hardware, whatever, you want to run down to the store and you want to get it. And at that point, you don't really, choice doesn't really matter, availability is a bigger issue, and so the first game of those hardware guys is inventory. The second game is they're a bank, because if you're a building contractor of any kind, you're going to go into the store, buy stuff on credit, sell it to your end consumer, and then go back and pay them. So hardware stores do two things, inventory and banking. And if you don't understand that, there's no way that you should be building a messaging system into a hardware company. And so when we think about these skill sets, we actually think that the T model is actually pretty complicated and is not just about technology, but it's also about design, and frankly, it's about business, which means it's now about a little more breadth than you might have thought it was about before. So let's drill down a little bit into the architectural view. Architects, both infrastructure and app dev, spent way too much time arguing about the beauty and religion of a methodology, a drawing, a style, dots and circles and arrows. It actually really doesn't matter. But it becomes this emotional thing about whose diagram is better, whose taxonomy is more interesting. The key thing about the diagram is, can you articulate what you're trying to do, and can people understand what it is that you're trying to say? That's the simplicity of the diagram, and we spend way too much time debating the beauty, perfectness, etc., of the methodologies that we use. Architecture is also a language. It's a language used to describe a system, complex system, but it could be a simple system, but also a tool to help you make decisions about what technologies you use, how you use them, what choices you're going to make, how you're going to design the system, how the various subsystems are going to interact with one another. That, to a large degree, becomes the essence of great design and of great architecture. It's also a reflection of the wisdom of the people. And to a large degree, that means that it's tough to be a great architect if you haven't built systems that have been broken, and systems, you don't have the experience of building different kinds of systems in different ways, in different countries, with different user scenarios, in different technologies. Wisdom in architecture is incredibly undervalued, and in fact, being able to listen to people who've done it before, who actually can point out potential vulnerabilities, is incredibly important. And when I talk to audiences, I think this is actually two important vectors. Is one, those with the wisdom need to help those who don't have it, and those who don't yet have the experience need to take the time to listen to those who do, and balance between those. But being able to predict instability, being able to predict uncertainty in the design is incredibly, incredibly important. I have a team that works for me that does technical quality assurance for all of the projects that we do worldwide through Microsoft Services, which is about 800 engagements a month around the world. And we've had to build a culture, notion of what technical quality looks like and do a series of technical reviews on projects. And it's pretty interesting. The more reviews you do, the more they look the same. And it's pretty easy to go into the design when this is the 500th that you've looked at this month and actually anticipate the kinds of things that might happen. And so we've produced internally a series of questionnaires depending on what type of project you're doing. If you're doing a link deployment, for example, have you thought about these 10 things? Because these are common mistakes that we see. What is fascinating is those mistakes are exactly the same mistakes around the world. It doesn't really matter where you are. It doesn't really matter on the size of the systems. We see pretty much consistency around the world in the kinds of design errors and design flaws that are being introduced. The good news is that they're very fixable, and like any good design, if you catch them early on, it's much easier to fix them in the project than later on. Architecture is also about visual simplicity. I cannot emphasize how important it is in the ability to describe a system and show a complex system in a simple way. You know one when you see it. When you look at an architecture and you look at a design, you can tell something that has been done incredibly well. Conversely, you can also tell something that is not as clear when you actually look at this Visio diagram with all the spaghetti that I showed early on. So what's the point? What's the real business and value of great design? What's the business value of architecture? How durable are the things that you're developing? How durable are your applications? When you design an application today, do you ever think about what your application might look like in 2 years, in 3 years, in 5 years, in 10 years? I mean, who's going to be the lucky person in 10 years' time who's going to have to fix all the things that you did wrong? How much have you actually thought about the durability of your application? Some of those old COBOL apps that I talked about, they've been around for a long time, and in reality, have been pretty durable. But how many of the applications, the infrastructures that you're designing today, have you actually thought about the durability? I'll put it in a very pragmatic context. I'm sure many of you have been backing up your pictures and your music at home on writable CD-ROMs. Hopefully you've been refreshing those for a while, because many of you have done that for the last 10 or 15 years, and the ones that you've done 15 years ago, if you've had them near any heat or any light, have probably decayed and are unreadable. So durability of assets is an incredibly interesting topic. And as you are developing applications and thinking about applications, it really is pretty important to think about the durability of what you're doing. And frankly, many of us don't. We just jump into the design, do the work that we've got to do, and then move on. But think a little bit about what it is that you're leaving behind and what it is that other people are going to have to inherit. And some of this, frankly, in an interesting way, is talking about green IT, but green IT about the soft assets, not necessarily the hard assets. The durability of the assets that you produce is incredibly, incredibly important. And so when we think about leadership, technical leadership, leadership is actually a sort of pretty complicated journey, and each one of us has taken a rather circuitous path to get to the point that you're at today. No matter where you've started, you might have started in some interesting places. You might be a DBA today but never thought that you would be a DBA before. You might be building out link infrastructures or virtualization migration schemes. Would you have thought of that you were doing that 5 years ago, let alone 10 years ago? Interestingly enough, my background is in real-time control systems and electrical engineering, and I have no formal background in software. But probably in hindsight have a pretty decent background in system design, but never would have thought that I'd be working inside of a software company. And so life in that sense is a journey, and it's very hard to predict where you'll be in the next 5 or 10 years. And the easiest way to think about it is think what you were doing 5 or 10 years ago compared to what you're doing today. So what is technical leadership not? This is a Visio diagram done by some Microsoft guys actually in India. That's a collection of all of our enterprise products. It's kind of in 2-point font. I'm happy to give this available to you if you want. But technical leadership is not knowing about every product. In fact, if you just look at the Microsoft product suite, there is absolutely no way that you can understand every product that we've got to any degree of depth. To give you a sense of how much we do, I talked about this event called Tech Ready that we do internally. We generate about 1,300 hours of content every 6 months on our on this product portfolio. That's about 2,500 hours a year. So if you're inside of Microsoft, you could spend every working hour getting ready, not doing any work, just to be in time to actually pick up the next cycle. So there is no way that you can actually understand everything. The question is for you is, what is the scope that you want to identify? What is the scope where you want to be known for? And do you want to be known to be somebody who's very deep about a smaller set of things? Or do you want to be known as somebody that has breadth across a multitude of things? And for folks, more junior people coming up through the organization, this is a huge dilemma in you go from that transition about being deep to being broad. There are still many folks inside of our company. We're very fortunate inside of Microsoft that we do have people who are incredibly deep about a handful of things. We actually have corporate vice presidential level positions for individual contributors in technology, guys who understand storage systems or networking or virtualization or user experience, that are deep and narrow in their expertise. But we also have a ton of people who are sort of very broad and work on sort of very deep architectures as well. What's interesting, and I think what the cloud is causing, is a transformation for us to think about workloads. This is just a random collection of workloads. To think about workloads and not necessarily individual technologies. One of the interesting discussions that I've had in talking to people about private clouds, for example, is most of the work about private clouds is being done by the infrastructure guys. They're really thinking hard about how virtualization should be defined, what is the management architecture for virtualization. But you know what? A private cloud by itself can only do two things. It allows you to log in and hopefully allows you to print. But a private cloud without workloads doesn't actually mean anything. And it's the workloads that are going to get very interesting. Designing a private cloud for Exchange is very different than designing a private cloud for Link. If you think about the latencies of what's required for a voice application to run in a private cloud, that could actually destroy some of the theory that's been implemented so far about how networking should be deployed in your private cloud, because you can't do VoIP activation and SIP activation through your network architecture that exists today. So when you're thinking about something like a private cloud, you have to think about the workloads and the applications that are going to run on that. What I see happening organizationally in some companies today is typically organizations have, you know, two big groups, the apps guys and the infrastructure guys, and sometimes they talk, but in many cases they don't. We're starting to see a group form in the middle, which is the group that thinks about workloads, that thinks about services, that is starting to make some progress and think about the integration across those two. In some cases, I see that third organization being managed to apps, some in infrastructure. And in some companies, I actually see a third organization growing that does that. What's interesting about private cloud, in this picture, this is a capability view of some of the technologies in a private cloud. Networking, identity, virtualization, management, runbooks. There's a whole series of underlying technologies that are here and how they're interconnected. The interesting question from a skill set perspective is, where does the governance sit? If your company is building out, or you're consulting with a company to build out a private cloud, who owns the private cloud? Who is the architect who has governance? Who is the person or people who decide on how that should happen? And frankly, who's the rocket scientist who understands all of these underlying technologies? Because there's nobody who actually has great deep depth technology on each one of these underlying elements. And so we have to, one of the biggest changes that we see is actually is this movement from underlying technologies to what we call capabilities and then to workloads. So here's a simple career model. I learned this model when I was working for Exxon over 30 years ago, and it's still pretty pertinent today. So first, there's an axiom which says, in any lifetime,
we all have multiple careers. I mean, each one of you has potentially worked at multiple companies, and even if you stayed inside of one company, you've probably changed jobs. So in every lifetime, you have multiple careers. And when you start a career, four stages to the career. The first stage is you're an apprentice. You're new to the job. You're learning who you interact with. You're learning the technologies, the customer, the business, you know, all the breadth of the job. And by the way, this could be you're a programmer, changing languages, working on a different company. Or frankly, you're the chief architect, but you used to work at a bank and you now work at a telco. It's not necessarily an entry-level job, but it's you're new to the role that you're in and you're trying to understand that role. So the first one is you're an apprentice. The second stage is you're then a journeyman. You understand the job, you know really well how to do it, you know how you interact with others. The third stage is getting success through others. And the fourth stage is success through strategy. Here's the dilemma. There's this huge chasm in the middle between being great at your job and getting success through others. What we do in the industry, we do it internally, and I'm sure many of you do it as well, is we take somebody who's a great developer, and we say, congratulations, you're a development lead. And that tends to not work that well. Not everybody can be a leader, not everybody can be a manager. Being able to let go and let somebody else be successful and to allow them to get to the same endpoint but maybe take a different path is incredibly stressful and strenuous to those people who are not ready to do it. And so one of the first things that we look for in technical leadership is for people to describe to us how they've helped other people be successful, not only in their own job. That could be you're working in a shared source environment. It could be that you're providing guidance to others. It could be that you're playing this lead role where you don't have any managerial control, but you're influencing a whole group of people with you. That chasm is where we see most technical people failing. Because you're great at what you do doesn't make you a great leader and it doesn't make you a great manager. You're still a great engineer. In fact, you could be a wonderful engineer contributing to the company and the success of the company, you know, as a customer or as a consultant. It just doesn't mean that you're playing that leadership role. You're still very important to the company. The work that you do is incredibly related to the success of the company. It's just you're not what we think is technical leadership. So what is technical leadership? So what I'm going to go to now is actually walk through a series of behaviors that has a lot of text on it. I'm not going to go through all of the text. You can read it. Happy to leave the slides with you. Pick them up afterwards. But I sort of walk you through some of the common themes and the things that we look for in the behaviors of leaders. So you've got to start off with some axioms, and excuse the math background, but I kind of spent some time doing mathematics. So the question is, in the work that you do, how important is repeatability and predictability versus innovation? Innovation is complicated. It turns out, if you talk to most of your customers, internal customers and external customers, what they want from you primarily is predictability. What you want is innovation. You actually want to play. You want to do things. You want to innovate. You want to test things. You want to use new APIs, new products. Push the edge. And the question is, where is the balance? And so in any of the engagements that you're doing, one of the very important things to establish up front is this reference model. Of how much scope, what is the expectations of predictability and repeatability versus innovation, so that you know the rules of the game. This issue of sustainability of solutions, I actually think is something as an industry that we need to focus on. In the same way that we focused on green IT, I think we need to focus on sustainability of our solutions. And then, as you take on different elements, do you have the right set of capabilities to do it, or are they available to you through other people? Are you connected in the right way to get that to happen? So let's start off with this, which is, in order to be a leader, you just need to be really good at what you do, to start. Know your job well, know what it is that success means, think about your job, how can you make it different? A very important aspect of this is don't be a victim. The last point here, and I see this often, which is, I'm having a conversation with somebody, frankly, both internally and externally, and what I get is a whole series of excuses about why I couldn't do something. It happens repeatedly, all the time, in fact. I couldn't do this because somebody else that. What we're looking for when we start to look for leadership is people who can navigate around that. As soon as you see a roadblock, understand the roadblock, understand how you make the other person successful, and work with them. But it's something that is a recurring problem for technical people, is the dilemma of, I can't do this because. And it is complicated. Know your customer. The example that I gave you about Home Depot earlier. Know your customer, know your customer's customer, know your customer's suppliers. Know the language of your customer, know their products, know their competition. Know everything about the customer when you're working with them. This is actually pretty tough for somebody who's a great developer or, you know, deep into the technology, but understanding the environment with which when you're working is incredibly, incredibly important. The newspapers that you read, the journals that you read, should not just be technical blogs about the latest smartphone and what features it has on it. You need to understand a little bit about the dynamics of the industry within which we live, the industry inside of the country, but frankly, the industry more broadly. I got a question this morning from an analyst writing an article, which is a question that arises for Microsoft often, which is, will you build a cloud data center in Australia? You have to be able to answer that question. So my challenge to all of you is, right now we do not have a plan to build a data center in Australia. And frankly, it's part technical, because it has to do with the latency of the target market and the ability to have a data center here being able to share capacity around the world. But it's also about business, which is that those data centers that we build have anywhere from 50 to 100,000 servers in them, and we have to be able to generate local consumption. I don't know if there's 100,000 servers in the city. So, you know, 100,000 servers is a lot of servers. The economics of that data center don't play for us, but there's also a technical decision. You have to be able to be articulate about that. You need to be able to be articulate about the language of your customer, whether it's business language, about ROI, but also the words that they use that describe their products and services. You know, CRM is a very interesting product. I can take a CRM system that knows about customers and suppliers, and I can change the words and have the words being doctors and patients and hospitals, and the workflows and processes that exist in CRM are exactly the same as if it was a marketing program. The words and language and semantics and context of a business need to be, you need to understand those and how they map across into the more generic spaces. So we're seeing Microsoft CRM being used in multitudes of industries just by changing the words and actually maybe potentially customizing some of the workflow. So understanding the language of the business, the semantics of the business, the success criteria of a business is incredibly important. Thinking strategically with the customer, not necessarily just tactically about the solution that you're working on, but thinking about them strategically, simply how do you help them make money? It's one of the most interesting discussions that I get involved in around search. Because most people think about search as just running a search engine, whether it's the fast search engine, just running across a whole bunch of documents in SharePoint. That's not really about making money. That's about collaboration. How can you use search to do digital marketing that allows a company to have a web presence that they sell more product? That's what search is about. That's really what search is about. There are some interesting websites that you can go to. I'll give you an example. When you go to Dell, I'm sure every one of you at some point has gone to the Dell website and then configured a machine. Interesting aside, I was talking to the Dell guys who run that system. The lurkers, the people who do that, they actually have a name for people like us who go in and look at machines, and they use that data. Every time you configure a machine on the Dell website, they actually use that data to do marketing analysis about why you didn't buy it. If you think about how many times did you configure a machine on the Dell website before you bought one? And they use the marketing information behind that for them is incredible about what you did, what you selected. Did you select the same thing every time hoping you would get a different price, or did you actually add more features? They use that data because they know who you are and they know what you've done previously, and there's incredible marketing business intelligence that they've got there. And so those kinds of things, that kind of information is how you help companies make money. And so thinking strategically is not necessarily about technical strategically, but also from a business perspective and what is achievable. Driving for impact is incredibly important. I see many people doing tasks, but not necessarily owning the result of the task. A big part of this is failure. Failure is actually great. Go for as much as you can, as quickly as you can, but don't overcommit. Quote from a guy, David Vaskovich, who I worked for about 10 years inside of Microsoft, is we always overestimate what we can do in 1 year and underestimate what will happen in 10 years. You think 10 years ago about what we were talking about. So it's 2011, in 2000, we just shipped Windows 2000. I mean, think about what's happened between Windows 2000 and now, Office 2000 and now. Nobody was even talking about the cloud 10 years ago. And so we actually underestimate 10 years, but we always, systems people always are optimistic about what is possible. Stopping is also incredibly important, and it's something that we look for internally for behaviors. In fact, Microsoft is quite Darwinian internally. We might actually spawn multiple projects around the same concept and let all those teams progress until a point that we've decided that one is more important than the other, and then we'll stop the first ones and proceed with the others. In some cases, there might be three or more doing that. The ability to stop is incredibly important, and the ability to call failure is incredibly important. And having a manager being able to do that is a fantastic attribute, to be able to stop something and say, look, this is not going to work. Because again, we tend, by our very nature, frankly, to be incredibly optimistic about what's possible. And if you just let me fix this one thing, I'll have it there. We see that constantly. But actually stopping something is incredibly, incredibly important. Learning, listening, and sort of staying relevant, staying current, not necessarily just in the technology, but the things that are happening around the technology. And by the way, you can never learn everything. And so part of learning is learning about who you can trust. Who can you trust in terms of input? So if you have a question to ask, who can you go and talk to who's going to give you great input? I run probably one of the largest SharePoint systems inside of Microsoft, which is a community-based system across 20,000 technical people around the world internally. And a big part of that is how can you find the person who's the expert in the area that you have a question about? It's pretty important to our business. Frankly, it's pretty important to anybody's business because there's no way that you can actually learn everything. And so part of the trick is learning who you can trust and whose opinion you can trust. In some cases, like any good consultant, when you're on the plane flying to the customer, you're reading the manual, and as long as you're two pages ahead of the customer, you look better than they do. But you can't always do that. In fact, you have to be able, in many cases, to draw on the knowledge of others to help you understand some of the more sort of intricate elements of what's there. The underlying message behind the learning is synthesis and pattern detection. It's one of the real behaviors that we look for in our technical leaders. Can you take multiple inputs from disparate resources, put them together in your head, and start to connect the dots between them and synthesize? And it's synthesizing opinion from fact. It's synthesizing across multiple industries. It's synthesizing across multiple scenarios. But it's one of the key behaviors that we see as incredibly differentiated from our leaders is being able to sit in a meeting and suddenly have an aha moment, which is, I've seen something like this somewhere else. I've seen something over there. And then trying to merge those two things together. That makes for great leadership. It makes for great leaders. It also makes for people who can make others incredibly successful, because what you're doing is saying, I know I've connected what you've done and what you've done. You guys need to talk because there's stuff together that you haven't quite realized because you don't know about it, the others existing potentially. And so synthesis of patterns is incredibly, incredibly important. Part of that is listening. And frankly, it's listening and what I would call approachability, which is listening to everybody all the time. It's part of what I do in part of my job. I travel probably 40 or 50% of my time has been traveling around the world. And just listening to people all the time, junior people, senior people, it's incredibly important about what you can learn. And part of what you've got to learn, frankly, is the filtering system, which is as all this input is coming, what's the babblefish saying to you about what the actual input is and how you can decode that and, frankly, discard some of it, but remember it in the back of your head because you never know when you're going to use it. So the ability to digest the information and remember the information and synthesize it, incredibly, incredibly important. Keeping current and keeping hands-on, frankly, it's part of what I do. I run every piece of beta software that Microsoft has. I live on the edge. Partly, that's who I am. That's why I've worked at this company for over 20 years. But it's really important to actually stay current with what's happening and do as much as you can in order to do that. And frankly, to do that, you have to be hands-on. You have to be inside the products, understanding what they are, doing the labs, experimenting as much as you can to the time that you can. What's very important, and it's a question that I ask many folks who I talk to, what is the body of work that you've done? Don't tell me what project you're doing. Don't tell me the tasks that you're doing now. But what is the body of work? So when I look at a resume, I actually don't care what university you went to, nor do I care what grades you got. Tell me what you've done. Tell me what you've done individually. Tell me what you've done as part of a team. And trying to understand the body of work that people have, what you've done, what you think you need to do. As I mentor people, and I spend a lot of time talking, one of the first things I'll ask them is to build a SWOT analysis. SWOT is a marketing term: strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. Do a SWOT analysis on yourself. Normally, people do SWOT analysis on products. Do a SWOT analysis on yourself. What are your strengths? What are your weaknesses? What are your threats? What are your opportunities? How much are you introspective about yourself? And how much do you know about where your opportunities are and what you could do and how you could change? A big part of that really comes from the way you collaborate and share and network. There is absolutely no way that anybody can know everything today. And your ability to connect and collaborate and share is amazing. You can learn so much from other people. Part of it is about building goodwill and building up political capital. Start with yourself. Give to others, and it's amazing what you'll get back as you sort of hook into that network. Find the great people in the network today. Go talk to them. Share with them. And what an amazing opportunity you've got, an event like this, whether you're going crazy on the go-karts yesterday or running around internally, to find somebody who thinks like you do and have a conversation with them. But also find the people who are the up-and-comers, because you might be surprised one day because you might land up working for them. And so find people in the sort of both spectrum. Seek out talent. Do what you can. But never leave broken glass behind. That's sort of a personal fundamental belief of mine. Never do something that breaks a relationship. I see this happen too often where people get angry about something and really break the glass behind them. Because the key in breaking the glass when you leave it behind is you never know, one day you might have to go back and walk down that broken glass path again. And so a philosophical question, and something that I'll talk to many of our leaders on, is have you done this? Where have you done it? And what have you done to fix the situation that you left behind? This is a model around community engagement. And if you think about the roles that you all play in communities, online communities, network communities, personal communities, the majority of people sit on the outside. They're lurkers. They watch what's happening. They see what everybody else does. If you want to go buy a new digital camera, you'll go into a website and see what everybody else said. But you'll never jump in yourself. I find it incredible how few people who have unbelievably strong opinions will actually go in, or not go in rather, and give an opinion. The core to great community is being a creator. It's being at the center of that community and collaborating and getting the synergies of the interaction with others, whether you can touch them or talk to them, or whether you're just part of a whole virtual community. But how it is that you can be an active creator inside of a collaboration community and participate like that. You never know, you never realize just how fantastic it can be, particularly in diverse environments. Diversity, diversity of experience, diversity of age, all elements of diversity inclusion create for fantastic solutions. And the part that diversity brings is you never would have thought about it yourself, because you don't have all of that exposure. And so we'll look internally, as I talk to people, what have you done to contribute into the community? Lurking and getting information out of it is all good and well, but what have you done to add value to others? Part of the community is then mentoring, not only your own mentor, but mentoring others. Standard question I'll ask, who's your mentor? Do you have one? Do you have one inside your company? Do you have one outside of your company? It's incredibly valuable to have somebody you can talk to who actually is not emotionally attached to the environment that you're dealing with. So advisable to everybody and anybody to both be a mentor and have a mentor, at least more than one. And frankly, mentor across diverse boundaries as well, because it's amazing what you will learn from everybody else, no matter which side of that fence you're on. Interesting perspective, and frankly, I stole this from Craig Newberg, who's the guy from Craigslist. He's written a book that's very, very interesting, and if you've got some spare time, try and follow up with what he says. But he has this great axiom that he lives his life by, which the quote is, give the other guy a chance. Because so often we're terribly judgmental about people, and his view is it's not the end of the world. Give the other guy a chance, and maybe stuff will happen. I actually love that, but I love the idea about being the optimist. And one of the things that we've seen and continue to see, frankly, is that optimism breeds optimism and pessimism breeds pessimism. Be an optimist about the things around you, what's possible and not what's impossible. So I'm a guy who's a quarter glass full. I don't think of something as being three quarters empty. It's not even half and half. I always need to think about what's possible and what's possible with people and how you can change people and make them better. Part of that, frankly, is about being visible. Being visible in the audiences where you need to be visible. And so that is, why aren't you guys on this stage speaking? Each and every one of you has something that you're passionate about and something that you care about. You know, there's 3,000 people at this event and 170 speakers or 150 speakers. Why aren't there 2,000 speakers? So be visible. And be visible is be visible as a speaker, be visible as a writer, communicate, and frankly have an opinion about something. It's part of your personal marketing plan. And so as you start to develop your own SWOT analysis, your marketing analysis, you need to think about what's your marketing plan against your SWOT analysis. So if you're trying to plan for a promotion or you're trying to plan for playing a different role on the project, what are the marketing things that you need to do to make sure that you get that opportunity? Nobody's going to give you the opportunity. You actually need a marketing plan for that particular career step that you're taking. Think about who you have to talk to, what you have to convince them of, and why it is that they should pick you over somebody else. It's classical marketing. It's the same thing as if you were buying a detergent for a washing machine. It's the same issues that you're dealing with, except you're the topic and not the washing machine. And what you have to think about is when you have an opportunity that comes up with, what are the dimensions of that opportunity? Why won't you get it? Why should you get it? What are the things that you have to do to convince somebody that you should get it? And what makes you stand out from the crowd that's sitting behind you? In order to do that, you've got to be creative. You've got to continue to innovate. You've got to continue to demonstrate the things that you can do and the things that differentiate you. I spent quite a lot of time in India, which is, for me, just fascinating. Hey, I love to travel there. But the drive to differentiate in that community is astounding. I'm sure many of you are familiar with the Imagine Cup, which is a program that Microsoft runs for college students, a competition that runs globally. I was in New Delhi when we did the Imagine Cup in New Delhi. They had 95,000 students who registered for the Imagine Cup, resulting in about 3,500 teams submitting major submissions, software and hardware submissions, and we had to pick six of them to win. But the desire to differentiate in India is above anything else that I've seen. And part of that differentiation, frankly, is the ability to be creative and to innovate under the right circumstances. You need to be very conscious in the situations where you're sitting. Body language is pretty important. Body language when you're presenting, body language when you're in a meeting. Be very conscious of those around you and the ability to change and adapt. Just a little bit about my presentation style. You'll see that later today. Most of my slides, not this deck at all, but most of my slides are just images. And the reason that I put images in and not text is I can adapt the spiel that goes with the text based on the audience, and I do adapt in real time. And it's very important when you're doing that to really understand the audience that you're talking to, as well as your ability to interact with them and communicate with them. Be very clear when you're in a meeting what your personal objectives are, what the objectives of the meeting, and what's, I really like this quote, what's your unique genius in this situation? What is it that you bring to the table in this situation that actually is going to differentiate you from the others? Associated with that then is doing the right things, working the right things, but not only the right things, work them in the right way. Be a change agent. This is back to the don't be a victim point. Be selective about what you do. Be patient in the sense of you can't do everything, and in some cases you might have to let go of some things. But make sure that you're picking the right things that you want to do. Most of us sort of have this sense of loss if you decide not to do something. Deciding not to do something is just as important as deciding what to do. Decide on the things that you need to do that are going to make you and those around you successful. And in some cases, albeit uncomfortable, it might actually be the right thing to walk away from something because you don't feel that you can be successful under the circumstances at that point in time. And then what are the things you have to change in order to make that successful? You have to be self-aware to do that, and you have to be incredibly self-critical. So the first thing is be self-critical. Know your surroundings, know the people, but also get input from others. Get input from others who you trust. You need to be able to go to somebody and say, how did I do? Should I change differently? One of the fantastic things about this event is your ability in real time to actually either tweet or, frankly, through the eval process that we've got, send those eval comments back. I can tell you, speaking at many events, I go back and read everything that everybody says. It's incredibly important to look at what people's opinions are and whether they agreed with you or disagreed with you. You can debate them, but if somebody takes the time to tell you something, it's important enough that you should actually look at it and really take that input. So seeking out opinions from people you know, people you don't know, incredibly important. Looking at it from sort of an inside out as well as an outside in perspective. This is one of the toughest things for many people is the ability to influence. The ability to influence people around you. What that means is to get somebody to do something that they didn't think about and that they didn't want to do, where you had a great idea. And part of the trick is to actually make it their idea. This is really hard. It's something best observed. It's something, watch great people do it, learn how to do it yourself. But part of it is connecting the dots. Your ability to influence, to some degree, is based on your ability to help somebody else be successful. So how is it that you can actually take something that you've learned or seen or witnessed somewhere else and pass that data on to somebody to help them be successful? Giving them data and information in real time that's useful to them is incredibly valuable. Once they've committed to something, it's very difficult to change, but your ability to influence is based on context as well as time. And part of that, by the way, a very important part of it, is giving credit to where credit is due. So even though it might not be your idea, if you're the agent of change, connecting the originator through the agent is also incredibly important. So with that then is thinking about the all-up solution. Thinking about the assembly of the components and the success of the components. Would you have been in this business if you had the opportunity, would you do this yourself? Or are you just doing it because somebody's paying you to do it? I always ask that question of somebody, and they say, well, no, if I was doing it in my own business, I would do something different. Why would you do something different if it's your business and not somebody else's business? So it's very important to think about sort of the aggregate view, know all the components, but frankly, know the solution as well. So it leads to sort of four pillars of decision-making when you look at any project. The first one, well, what I'll ask people to do is to weigh these pillars. When I see a new design or a new architecture, I'll ask them to weigh these individual pillars and tell me how important you think they are within your application. So the first one is repeatability and predictability. The second one is around innovation. And the balance between those two is incredibly important. Tell me whether this is an 80% innovation or a 20% innovation. Because I, as a manager, as an investor, might make different decisions based on the sort of fraction between those. How sustainable is your solution? I ask that question all the time now. And also, how capable are you? Do you have the right people with the right skill sets to do it? Because I still see people taking on projects that are great from a design perspective, but you don't have the right people to implement them. So if, when I look at any design, those are the four questions I ask as the meta level about the work that you're doing. Once you've got that design, the biggest challenge is making it happen. Back to don't being a victim, make sure that you can drive the behavior, understand the problem you're trying to solve, understand what success looks like. In many cases, we don't. We think that success means user acceptance. User acceptance isn't a binary thing. Generally, when we roll out a system, an infrastructure, a system, we actually say, have the users accepted it? And the answer to that is not yes or no, because there are many different kinds of users. And so user acceptance is actually a maturity model. You have different users of different maturity, pick four levels or whatever it is, and you need to measure the acceptability of your system to all the users, a novice user, an expert user, rather than just the sample community that you've self-selected of who are the people who you think are going to say yes. And so when you make it happen in the right way and think about what acceptability is and who says yes and who says no. Also part of making it happen is making it not happen, which is the fail early, get out quickly. And one of the things that we absolutely drive for is showing progress on a day-to-day basis. Probably one of the most important elements of building out any system. As many of you may know, when we do developments, both infrastructure and projects, we do what's called daily builds. We run those builds every single day. So no matter what the code check-in is, we will actually run those builds and automated tests every single day. And the guy who makes the build is the goat of the week, and they have to fix the build because they're holding up everybody else. It's amazing how the dynamic behavior of daily build changes the quality of what people do. Because when you check something in, everybody's going to know in a couple of hours whether you've checked in something good or not. There's also some very interesting work that actually is being done in New Zealand with the Department of Defense looking at an incremental build model for infrastructures. Because generally we think about infrastructure deployment as you start, you deploy the infrastructure. But are there ways where you can actually deploy infrastructures incrementally, not necessarily on a daily build, but deploy them incrementally so you can actually show incremental success on an infrastructure, not only on an application development project. And so all of this, frankly, is in the topic of you own it, you make it happen, because frankly, if you play the victim and wait around for everybody else, it's not going to really take place. So to a large degree, frankly, you own your own success. Too often, as I said, I get excuses about why people are not successful. You need to define your own success, both in the work that you're doing, but frankly, also in your career. At any point in time, if you go back to my career model, I'll ask people, what does the success mean in your next stage? What does it mean in this stage? And in some cases, people are very happy just doing great development work themselves. But be articulate about, in your own life model, what you think success means now. And then, what does the stretch model look like? What does the next stage of success look like? Incredibly important is having an opinion. It's being able to stand in front of an audience, both logical and physical audience, and have an opinion. Take a stand about something. Are you passionate about what it is? Have an opinion, be confident, be sure, which means if you're not confident and you're not sure, you probably shouldn't be there. But when you do take a stand, it's incredibly important to take that stand, understand the opinions of others, rationalize your opinion against theirs, and come up with a third view that's sort of the aggregate about it, but be passionate about something. And so when we do these internal development boards inside of my business, there's a board that takes place. It's about an hour interview in front of the board. The last 15 minutes are, tell me something you're passionate about. I actually don't care what it is, but tell me something that you're passionate about. Because what I want to see is somebody who cares about something and is articulate about it and researches it. And I'll give you a great example. We did one of these boards recently in New York, and we bring in people from around the world, and there was somebody who came through from Eastern Europe. And the thing that he cared about, seems pretty pertinent to this country in New Zealand, I'm finding out, was coffee. Coffee to him was important. And he gave us a 15-minute dissertation on coffee machines, automated machines, manual machines, grinding technology, pressure, pressure pumps, the perfect pressure, temperature. 15-minute dissertation on coffee, which is somebody who likes coffee, was pretty interesting. But not only did he talk about coffee and why he liked it, but out of that, I actually got the passion for what he was doing and the depth of the research that he was done and why he picked this coffee machine from that one and why he does something by hand and automated machines are a complete waste of time. I have an automated machine at home, by the way. And so it was just, I look for that in people, in the people who I interact with, which is, are you just sort of going through the motions, or do you actually care about something somewhere? And the final piece, frankly, is then about courage. It's the courage to stand up and have an opinion, the courage to stand up and not back off when pushed, to have conviction about what you do. But really, do you believe? This is actually pretty important. In organizations, the people who work around you, in some cases, struggle to figure out what you believe in and what you're important, what's important to you. If you're a manager, knowing what's important to you and communicating that to the people you work with allows the two of you to actually meet in a cultural way. If you don't do that, there's this impedance mismatch between what you think and what people think you think and the interactions that you have. So knowing who you are, what you believe in, is incredibly important to communicate to those around you. Not only upward, but in fact downward. One of the first things that I do as I meet with new people who are working with me is I wrote a blog about 3 years ago internally, which talked about the need to believe in what you believe in. And I shortened it down to this, but it's actually about 6 or 7 slides that go into sort of core beliefs. But this is something that's very personal. This is actually talks a lot about me, the things that I believe in. So I believe in the magic of technology. I love working at the company that I work at. I love being on the edge of the technology, playing with technology, geeking out with all the new gadgets. I also believe in the power of the customer. And my role inside of Microsoft, I sit between the product groups and customers and between sort of technology and solutions. And at that pivot point, I actually have 2 responsibilities inside of the company. One is technical strategy, making sure that customers are doing the right thing and we're giving them the right direction. But more interestingly, reflecting back to the product groups where there's white space between our products. And in that sense, the right of the customer to be right is incredible. It's amazing how often, you know, the designers, the program managers of our products haven't thought about a particular scenario. It just didn't get there. It just was out of scope for them. And so in looking at a scenario, there's nothing like the power of the customer saying, I was trying to do the following things with your product and I couldn't. And being able to communicate that back to the products and make the products better, for me, is an amazing thing. I believe in the power of teams. I believe in the power of individuals. And obviously, there's a tension between that. In family, both your family at home, but frankly, your family at work. For most of us, unfortunately, you probably spend more time with the folks at work than you do with the guys at home. And so the sense of family and the importance of the connection of those family extends not only at home, but also to work. I believe in diversity, as I explained earlier. Part of what I do is both learning. I read voraciously, consume incredible amounts of data, but also explaining and sort of the wisdom and what I've done over my 30 years in the industry and explaining that to people. I believe in transparency, just about being pretty clear about what I'm doing and how I'm doing it. And really the power of connection and the emotional connection of our customers and our products and the community to really make incredible difference to what we can all do together. Being clear about who you are and your personal values and the thing that you believe in is incredibly important when you're a leader and when you're a manager. Because if you don't do this, if you have a high value of integrity and somebody gives you an expense report that looks suspect, with a high integrity bar, suddenly alarms start going off in your head. Something as simple as somebody spending too much money on lunch drives you crazy because you have a high integrity bar. The earlier and sooner you can communicate something as simple as that to the people who work with you, it's incredibly important. But it's not just at that level. It's sort of at the fundamental emotional level where you need to be very clear kind of about who you are and what you do. And so to sort of come back full circle, to me, technical leadership is about these 3 things. It's the art, the science, the balance, and frankly, the courage to do the things that you believe in and that you don't believe in, not necessarily touch mice. And so we spent a lot of time, both internally, as I said, and now externally, trying to talk about leadership and what we think it is, What are the behaviors that we think are there? And it's not necessarily about the underlying technology, but frankly, it's the behaviors. The skill sets that you've got, I'll differentiate skill sets from behaviors. The skill sets that you have around technologies and products are incredibly important. But in order to be successful as a leader, it's actually all about the behaviors and not necessarily about the underlying technologies. We've been rolling out this program internally, as I said, for about 3 or 4 years and have been growing our senior technical people in this way, and now believe that it's pretty important that we communicate this in a broader audience so that we can actually share with you, you have an understanding of what we're trying to do, but we think that there's incredible value in sort of trying to be a little more articulate more broadly about what we think leadership is about. With that, I think we've got a little time for questions. 5 minutes for questions. 5 minutes for questions. Any question? ASP de Vespero. Yes, at the back there. Yep. So, I'm sorry, what was the second part? Yeah. So the question was, are we doing anything to help people help identify personalities, and what do we do about team building? There are numerous personality profile tools that we use to actually help people do that. Myers-Briggs, there's a color-coded behavior. We do a lot of that to actually help people understand sometimes. And it's always very interesting seeing the personality profile that you think you have versus that other people think you have. So the 360-degree assessment we think is really important. It's not just great if you do it yourself, because it's actually self-realizing. It's actually much more interesting doing what you think and those around you. We have some internal tools that we use that when we do this 360, which is we'll take your manager, your peers, and the people who work for you, if that's true, and actually map that back to you. And then we'll have a mentor work with you going through it, not necessarily your manager, because you want somebody at arm's length. It's always fascinating. No matter who you are and where you are in the organization, I guarantee you that there is never 100% concurrence between what you think and what other people think. So we use tools like that all the time. We use Myers-Briggs. I'm an ENTJ. Happen to be an extrovert, if that wasn't clear. But so we use lots of tools like that. From a team building perspective, that varies dramatically from small teams to big teams. In some cases, it's big teams. In some cases, it's smaller teams. I'll speak personally. I have people who live around the world who work for me. And so actually getting everybody together in one place at one time is very difficult. And we try and do that at least once a year, because as you can see, I think that teams are actually very emotional connected things. And I think having that connection is incredibly important. A consequence of that, and then again, this is about me, is I have people who have worked with me for me for 15 or 20 years. And because the styles overlap, I'm not sure who works for who in some cases, frankly, but the bandwidth of the communication is incredible. When there's somebody who you worked with for a long time, there's this babble chatter that goes back and forth, and if somebody's not in sync with it, they don't really understand what's happening. That's actually a great environment, but it's also bad because it doesn't allow other people to enter into that private communication domain. And so the notion of teams and changing teams and diverse teams and changing opinion of the teams, I think, is incredibly important. So the many tools that we have that we'll use in various types of team building, but I actually personally love some of these personality assessments and being vocal about it. The more you can talk to other people about who you are and what you believe in and what you don't believe in, the better off the world is, because that impedance mismatch suddenly disappears. Because you're no longer trying to make it up what you think somebody thinks. You're articulate about it. So I think that stuff is very important. A lot of this is the soft skills, but frankly, that is the nature of people and the business that we're in. Yep, there's a question here.
How do you treat a person or a team member who doesn't agree?
So I'm just going to repeat. So the question is, how do you treat a team member who has a different opinion, who doesn't necessarily agree? I can tell you personally on it. When I sit in meetings, I see myself more as a collaborator in the meeting, frankly, rather than as the owner of the decision. If I have to make the decision and decide on what I'm going to do, I can do that. But for me, it's much more about coming to a broader decision. In some cases, When there are people who actually disagree, part of what I'm trying to understand is, why are you disagreeing? Is it a disagreement in fact, or is it actually a disagreement in judgment? Disagreements in fact are easy to fix. You can actually go back and get the data. And that's sort of our first inclination is, do we have the same information or do you have different information? It turns out in many cases it's different information, and that's fairly easy to clear. If it's different opinions, then it's a question of, you know, to what degree do you believe in the opinion, don't believe in the opinion, and how can it work? If somebody is in a team for a long period of time and has a dissenting vote in the team broadly for a long period of time, I would actually say that's the wrong team. Having it happen frequently is fine. In other words, having a dissenting opinion and having actually think about something different or change is a great idea, but as long as it's done early on, fence-sitting and coming in after the fact saying, no, I wouldn't have done it that way, I don't have any time for that. So have your opinion at the right time and try and influence and force the change. But if you can't influence and force the change inside of a team, then the team dynamics are broken to some degree and need to be repaired. And the repair might vary. It might mean change some people, change the discussion, take time to understand it. So there's no magic answer that says if somebody disagrees, you've got to throw them out. No, you actually have to try and understand, you know, find the other people who are disagreeing with them. It's a complicated problem. Yeah.
How do you deal with superiors who try to micromanage you all the time?
How do you deal with superiors who try to micromanage you? And what do you do about that? Happens to us all. I have a perfect example. About 18 years ago, I had a job inside of Microsoft. This knock on my door with Steve, who said, we'd like you to go to Microsoft IT for 18 months. Like? And the answer was, yes, sir. And 18 months I did it, and 18 months and a day I moved. But there's part of that, I think, is actually the understanding of those beliefs and value systems between those two tiers, between you and the manager. Why is the micromanagement happening? Is it because they don't trust you? Is it because they want all the details? Is it because they were so used to doing it themselves, they want to continue doing it themselves? Those are all things that need to be resolved. One of the things that comes out that I found in many cases like that is because there is a lack of trust, now you've got a decision to make. If your manager doesn't trust you, do you want to stay and live with that? Because it's very stressful. You might actually understanding the stress within which you operate is incredibly important to being successful in what you do, personally successful. And if there's a lack of trust, something's got to change. Either you leave or he leaves or something else happens. But living in a stressful environment is not worth it. It's just not worth the energy. You know, you have this finite amount of energy, and if you're going to burn energy in stressful situations, you could actually be much more creative somewhere else. So being able, I think the first element is trying to understand why. Yes? Yes. Where did the title of the talk come from as opposed to Babelfish? It actually came from the view of that there needed to be some guide to leadership and some guide to what technical behaviors look like. Much as the Hitchhiker's Guide was your guide to the galaxy, that in this case, this should be your guide to what leadership is. It's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, frankly, when we were doing it, because if there was somebody in the audience who had the reference, you knew that they would come and try and find out. But hence the question about the airspeed of a sparrow, if you've got that connection. Exactly. Yes?
To what extent do you structure or formalize mentorships? I started working as an engineer and there was a very structured mentorship program. Mm-hmm. Moved into IT where I found kind of a distinct lack of mentorship, where it's just basically off you go, you know? To what extent, how do you view that?
So the question is around structured mentorship versus unstructured. It turns out inside of Microsoft we have a website and a tool that tracks mentorships, and you can sign up as a mentee on a mentor, and there's this beautiful matching system. Nobody uses it, actually. And HR go crazy because they love to track the stuff and count things and how many mentors do you have. But nobody uses the system because a self-imposed structure like that actually forces stuff that doesn't happen. So I actually, we land up doing it in a much more informal way. The roles of mentor and mentee are actually quite well understood. And what I will do, encourage people who work for me, is get a mentor in your immediate environment, but get a mentor who's actually organizationally remote. And there's enough culture in our organization where you can go to somebody and say, look,
you know, and I know a little bit about you, I'd love to have a chat. You go have lunch with them. Hey, can I just spend a little more time with you? Can we chat for an hour once a quarter? So there's enough built inside of our company that has the approved culture of the relationships that they happen. And they happen in kind of in volume. But there are scenarios that you describe, which is that nobody's got the time or the energy or sees the benefit of it. Then you've got to seek mentors outside of your immediate environment. You've got to go outside the organization in order to do it. But it would be interesting if you're inside of IT, inside of a big company, if you went to somebody inside of the marketing organization, distant organization, and said, hey, can we have lunch once a quarter? I have no idea what their reaction would be. They're probably thinking you were insane. But that's the kind of, in a provocative way, that happens. Unfortunately, I mean, while I'm on the road now, I got a piece of mail from somebody who worked for me 20 years ago who said, hey, I'm looking around. Can we have a chat? That sort of stuff happens all the time. The more you get engaged in it, the more it happens. The more you're a participant in that informality, the more it happens. If you actually stand back and watch, you're neither a mentor or a mentee. You're just watching. And so the problem with companies that don't think about it or don't support it is you have to kind of build those relationships yourself. Tough, but incredibly important. Having the organizationally distant view is also really important because you get so embedded in what's going on around you that having somebody else outside saying, why are you even doing this? Stop bashing your head against the wall. It's important having somebody who can say that, either at home or, frankly, somewhere else in the office. Question here. I'll come back to you in a sec. Yeah. So the question was, on consuming massive amounts of information, how do you articulate the filtering scheme? I think that's what the question that you asked. Experience. It's actually, the best thing to do would be to ask somebody, talk about them, what do you think about this, what are you reading, what are you writing, what do you care about? And over that, you start to synthesize what other people's filters are versus your own. The other one is looking at behaviors. Look at people who are successful and look at what they do. Don't always mimic them, because not everybody who's successful is a good person, just so we're clear. And so make sure that you're following the right people. Talk to them, understand what they do, I mean, one of the questions that I get quite often is, who do I follow? And the answer is, I don't follow anybody individually. I love seeing what's happening. I mean, the dynamics that's going on in our industry right now with companies being acquired and people leaving is fantastic. I mean, the dynamics of the phone business is changing in real time. Following that, understanding what's going on there, the dynamics of what's happening, to me, is just part of what makes this business a fantastic business. So follow, look, talk to people, ascertain what they're doing, and ultimately you end up building that sort of algorithm in your head yourself. There was a question up there somewhere. Yeah. So the question is, this sort of broad development versus on-the-job development versus sort of the life skill side of it. So on-the-job development is about skills, not behaviors. Do you know a particular technology? Do you know a particular product? In technology, do you know an API? Do you know an infrastructure? Do you know what that vendor's done, this vendor's done? Can you evaluate SAP versus something else? Those are all skills, not necessarily behaviors. Any individual, you actually sit in a matrix and you've basically got skills and behaviors and there's the blur between them that makes up the individual. Frankly, from a behavioral perspective, it's very hard to have behaviors at work that you don't have at home. And how you're seen at home and in the place that you work with and the people who you touch, those are you. Those are kind of things that define you. Changing behaviors is really hard. People tend to be kind of fixed in their behaviors and learning new behaviors and changing behaviors is probably a lot harder than learning a new API or a new compiler. And so we have a whole bunch of people who focus on technical readiness internally, skill set, more than you can ever consume. We don't have that much, frankly, on behaviors. And part of what we're doing right here is trying to articulate those behaviors and show people what we think of places where they should or shouldn't learn. So take that list of 57, look at three of them and decide this year I'm going to focus on these three. I'm going to be active in communities. I'm going to share. What are those things that you're going to do? But frankly, the blur between your behaviors at home and work are kind of different. I can tell you when I go home, I'm just probably I'm similar, but might be different as well. Yeah.
Why happens after leadership? Technical leadership.
The question is, what happens after technical leadership? We're very fortunate as a company. It's one of the reasons why I'm still at this particular company, is we have technical leaders who are at the executive level of our company. There actually is, you have the same opportunity as a technical leader than you do as a business leader. I'll give you the counterexample. Before I came to Microsoft, I actually worked for a large multinational oil company. I was in IT doing world-breaking stuff. I was one of the original beta test sites for OS2, distributed OS2 system. It was fun stuff. But in order to progress inside of an oil companies do three things. They find oil, they boil it, and they sell it. I'm not a chemical engineer. I don't play one on television. You know, that for me, that's not something that I believed in. It wasn't something that was fundamental. I had a great time. I had 12 years, and I learned an incredible amount there. But it wasn't what that company was not fundamental to what I was. And that's one of the reasons why I went to the company that I went to, is because it was the essence of the company. Many large commercial companies, banks, airlines, or whatever, have large IT businesses. You can be very successful in an IT business because it is core to what they do. And so they have the opportunity to actually grow from technical leadership all the way through. It's about the company and choices. So there are companies that actually have opportunity, and there are companies that have slightly less. There are companies that have very little. Those are all, your mileage might vary where you end up. I made the choice, you know, as I said, 20 years ago, because I wanted to be at the center of the whirlwind, and I've had the most fantastic career changing the lives of billions of people. You get few opportunities to do that. Last question, and then I'm being pulled. I'll hang around afterwards. Yeah.
How do you have rooms connected
to each
other? They need to work together.
Yeah.
Is there like
rooms of. So the question is about two groups that need to collaborate and don't, and how do you create that between them? The thing that we end up focusing on in that case, which is how do you have the dependencies between them? Can you create a cross-dependency, and is the dependency necessary from a business perspective, a timeline perspective, and where do those dependencies happen? And does everybody understand the dependencies? In many cases, you'll find teams that don't want to take on dependencies. We may let that happen, but in some cases, we may blow them up and say, nope, you're actually going to be, this is a strategic bet, you have to use this, get over it. So in some cases, it does take management discipline on top of it to actually impose those dependencies. Nobody can be independent of everything. And controlling your own destiny inside a big company is an interesting problem, but it never happens. And so how you dependent, how you create those interdependencies and the relationships on them is incredibly important. I need to finish. I'll stay around for a little bit longer. I'll be around the rest of the day. Thanks for staying.